I'm Emma Taylor.
I'm Joanna Shanks.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
What is your chat for me this week? Do you have any true crime chat?
Yeah, a little bit. Once again, I have been watching bits and pieces on the television. I watched this programme on Channel 5 that I was really interested in because of your case on Peter Sutcliffe. And it's called The Yorkshire Ripper's New Victims. Mm. So it's just victims that weren't technically tied to him or proven to be his, but they're pretty sure that it was him that did them for various reasons. There's one that the woman chose her e-fit and it is just him, basically. It just looks identical to him.
Was that the woman that was attacked and outside the car?
So that was one of them, yeah. Yeah, Carol was her name?
Yeah, I think so. And she, the e-fit that she gave him was like startlingly similar.
And there was a man that he'd attacked as well.
Wow. Really?
But not, there was no sexual motive behind it. He just attacked him and bashed him over the head in a similar way that he'd done with the others. And he was 100% sure that it was him. But it was just really interesting. It went back over some bits and pieces. So that was on Channel 5. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's go and have a look at that. And
I definitely will.
I know this is shocking because it's been out for so long, but we finally watched The End of the Fall. So have you seen it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you can really argue for spoiler alerts because it's been finished for ages.
Yeah, it's been out for a long time.
I just felt a bit deflated that he got to kill himself and get out of going through the justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bit raging, but such a good programme.
Good series,
so
isn't
good.
It?
Yeah, Jamie Dornan's good in it, and Gillian
Anderson.
I mean, she's phenomenal.
She's incredible. I mean, I never watched X-Files. It just was never my thing. So I don't think I'd really seen her in anything before until I watched The Fall. And I was like, my God, she's a bloody good actress. Like, the fact that she can not really even be saying anything, and she won't even be doing these really dramatic, over the top facial expressions, but she just has this way of conveying exactly what she wants to convey. And to be honest, I must not be that perceptible to these things, because it's not often that I notice things like that in television. I think I've said that before. So when I do notice it, I think it must be really good if I notice it, because I don't normally pay attention to that kind of thing.
Yeah, she's awesome. She's just amazing. I'm looking forward to seeing what she does next. And I don't know if they could even do anything else with The Fall. Maybe not, because the main guy is dead. But if they did a kind of a reboot of her, you know, doing the same thing, being a detective and doing other series, like, I would absolutely watch it in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
That's about it, I'm afraid.
Good. Well, good news as well, because next weekend, Line of Duty starts again.
Next weekend, as of us recording just now.
Yes, yeah. As of at the time we're recording now, yeah.
So hopefully when you've listened to this, you've already caught Line of Duty, and if you haven't, go and get it on catch up right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Listen to us later, it doesn't matter.
It's gonna be really painful for me, though, because I've never watched it in current time, so I'm going to have to wait for every episode each week, and I think that's going to be really difficult.
The irony is that when you and I were growing up, we didn't have on-demand TV or catch-up. Like, that is quite ironic that, you know, we grew up in a world where you just had to wait for the next thing.
And actually,
or you wait till Sunday when you watch The Omnibus.
That's true.
What I actually, I'm really like this with books as well. I get really hacked off if I buy a book. And this is the joy and the curse of the Kindle, is that you can buy the first book in a series and I blink and I'm on book 4. And then I get to the end and I frantically Google, where is book 5? And it's like, coming out 2022. And I'm like, no, you can't do this to me. I need to know what happens. The poor guy's sitting scribbling frantically somewhere and I'm like, give me the next novel. I must know.
Yeah, and that's why I like watching things that are already out or have already been written, you know, rather than getting things, you know, during the hype, because the wait is just painful.
Joanna, what case have you got for us this week? You have teased me by telling me it's a historical case, which is very exciting.
It is. It's a historical case from my favourite time. So it's Victorian era.
Amazing.
Quite a big case today. Well, I've got quite a lot of notes and I've done a little bit of, I like to do a little bit of background and history of the area and, you know, places and things that are involved as well. So I've done a little bit of that as well.
I can't believe you're not in period dress.
I would have expected that.
I know. Do you know, there's actually, just a quick aside, there's actually a place in Brighton and it's this old townhouse that's basically being restored to its original state, and they found the original paint underneath that the walls were painted in, this sort of beautiful kind of blue color. And obviously this is pre-pandemic, but I think it's like once a month they do a dinner thing, and basically chefs cook in the basement kitchen, and you sit upstairs and you have a meal, and it's cooked as of the time that when the house was built and when it was, you know, in all its glory kind of thing.
I would love that.
Yes. But I think what they also do is I'm sure they also do like a cookery class there, and you get to learn how to do that. So I said to Sean, I was like, please, can we do that? Because I think that would be really good fun.
It'll be good until you realise that you're eating like jellied pig Chaucer.
Yeah, exactly.
Tripe soup.
Yeah, I think I brought a sandwich. I think I'll just have that instead.
They totally had vegans back then, right?
Yeah. But yeah, anyway, so I have written it in a bit of a story format. So I'm just going to go through it. And if you do want to ask any questions along the way, just holler. Otherwise, we'll just have a little bit of a chat about it at the end. And I've got a little bit of history and a little bit of information about kind of Edinburgh in general at the time as well. So, in Victorian-era Britain, contraception didn't exist, nor did social services or bona fide adoption services. Abortion was illegal, and backstreet abortions carried huge risks in addition to being expensive. Serious infection or death as a result of a backstreet abortion was common. Additionally, women were prosecuted if discovered to have had a backstreet abortion. Abortion did eventually become legal in the UK, excluding Northern Ireland, but this took almost a further 100 years, with the Abortion Act being passed in 1967. Illegitimate children were common, and there was a social stigma around having a child out of wedlock. As such, many babies were given up. Abandonment was illegal, and if the mother did not have the means to raise the child, there were few other options available. In 1867, the term baby farmer appeared in several articles in the British Medical Journal. By the end of this year, the term had made its way into the media and caused panic. Collins Dictionary defines baby farming as a place that houses and takes care of babies for a fee, or a residence for unwed pregnant girls or women that also arranges adoptions. Advertisements in newspapers would offer a resolution for unwed mothers. The adverts would ask for a fixed lump sum or ongoing regular payments in exchange for taking their child into their charge. But raising a child was expensive, and it became apparent to unethical baby farmers that if the child died quickly, the profit margin would be large. Infant deaths were common in Victorian Britain, and few questions would be asked. One baby farmer stood trial charged with murder on 18 February 1889. She was a 27-year-old female called Jessie King. Jessie was born Jessie Keane in 1861 and was an orphan at a young age. She moved from institution to institution and eventually resorted to prostitution to support herself. Jessie eventually found work as a laundry woman in Stockbridge in Edinburgh and became pregnant to a man who had promised her a marriage. Thomas Pearson had left Glasgow, his wife and his children to come to Edinburgh to live with another woman. After the death of Pearson's lover, he seduced the heavily pregnant Jessie, who had come to help out around the house. Pearson was more than 30 years older than Jessie. Immediately, Pearson seemed to have exerted a strong hold over the vulnerable young woman, and she left her fiancé to live with Pearson. Though Thomas Pearson was running his own business, it was failing, and he resorted to drinking heavily. Jessie had begun baby farming, and Thomas was supported by the money she made. A few weeks after moving in with Pearson in 1887 in Shane Street, Jessie's new baby Grace suddenly vanished. Two young boys were playing in Shane Street in October 1888 when they came across a bundle of oilskins. They decided to use it as a makeshift football and began kicking it around. As the boys continued to play, the bundle fell apart and a decaying baby's body was discovered. The two boys... Yeah.
Oh my God. I could see where that was going and that still hit me like a ton of bricks.
Mm-hmm. The two boys ran to find a police constable and the baby was identified as Alexander Gunn, a one-year-old boy who had been in the charge of Jessie King. Police were led to Jessie King and Thomas Pearson. Police raided the house where Jessie and Thomas lived and found the remains of two babies. A baby girl was discovered in the coal cupboard and another on a high shelf wrapped in a coat. Jessie was arrested, together with Thomas Pearson, for the murder of just three babies, although police believed it was many more. When questioned at the police station, Jessie took full responsibility. The duty officer for the poor warned Jessie that her confession would result in her being hanged, but Jessie ignored his advice. The three children they were charged with murdering were 12-month-old Alexander Gunn, 6-week-old Violet Tomlinson, and 5-month-old Walter Campbell. Pearson was eventually released and turned Crown's evidence, testifying against Jessie King. He claimed to have been ignorant of the fate of the children in Jessie's charge. There was good reason to suggest Jessie had not been alone in the crimes. One of the babies was on a high shelf out of Jessie's reach and another was wrapped in Pearson's coat. Additionally, Jessie was illiterate. This has subsequently raised questions around the advertisements. Being unable to read or write, Jessie would not have been able to respond to adverts in the newspaper. The trial in the city's High Court lasted barely one day. The jury retired for a total of just 4 minutes before reaching a guilty verdict. The judge sentenced Jessie to be hanged for the murder of 1-year-old Alexander Gunn and 6-week-old Violet Tomlinson. The case of Walter Campbell was withdrawn during the trial. On the night of 10th of March 1889, Jessie said goodbye to her baby Thomas and was hanged the following day. Public executions had been abolished in 1864 and hangings took place at the jail. She was the first woman to be hanged in Scotland since 1862 and was the last woman to be hanged in Edinburgh. Jessie King was an uneducated, vulnerable, with a tendency to obey anyone that she saw as being an authority. When she served a prison term for breaking the concealment of pregnancy law, her jailers described her as a meek, law-abiding prisoner who was eager to please and followed instructions without question. Jessie is buried under the car park of St Andrew's House on Calton Hill. Nothing is known of her son, Thomas Keane. He was left in the care of the Catholic Church and not with his father, Thomas Pearson. Pearson returned to Glasgow soon after the execution of Jessie King, after residents of Edinburgh felt he had gotten away with child murder. He died in 1890 of a fractured skull. It is unknown whether he was attacked and killed or his death was the result of an accident. Given the short amount of time between Jessie's conviction and Pearson's death, it is believed he may have been attacked on return to his native Glasgow. And I've got here an excerpt from the Edinburgh Evening News in 1888. So this is from the time that she was standing trial. And I thought you might be interested to hear.
Yeah, how they think about it.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness.
So this is a couple of excerpts. I've narrowed it down. So, trial of Jessie King today. Jessie King was tried before the Lord Justice Clerk, Kingsborough, in the High Court of Justiciary, Edinburgh, today on a charge of murder. Today the sensation of hearing a murder trial was a strong attraction, and an hour before his lordship sat the public portion of the courtroom, including the side galleries, which are only opened on more than ordinary occasions, were crowded. A number of women were among the spectators. A large crowd in Parliament Square besieged the doors of the court, but could not be admitted. The prosecution was conducted by the Solicitor General, Mr. Darling, Mr. Graham Murray and Mr. D. Robertson, Advocate Depute. King was defended by Mr. Fitzroy Bell, instructed by James Young, W.S., who is one of the Poor's agents for the year. His lordship was punctually at 10:30, and after the disposal of two other cases, King was placed in the dock. She was accompanied by a female warder who, however, left her in the charge of the police as soon as the proceedings began. Prisoner was a miserable-looking creature and did not appear to take much interest in the proceedings. And then they reported on her declaration.
I was going to say, you wonder how much of it she really understood what was going on.
So in the prisoner's declaration it says, "The first evidence led was the prisoner's declarations, which were read by Mr. Veitch, the deputy clerk. In her first declaration, before Sheriff Rutherford on 5th of November, prisoner stated her wish not to say anything about the charges against her. In her second declaration, taken on 6th of November, she said she now wished to state that on 4th of April last, she got an illegitimate child named Alex Gunn from its mother. She thought the child was then 11 months and a fortnight old. The mother gave her £3 to adopt it. Thomas Pearson, with whom she lived, was unwilling that she should take the child, because they had nothing to keep it with. But when she told him she had got £3 for it, he agreed that she should keep it for 3 or 4 weeks. She got the child in May. Thomas Pearson was very fond of it. By the end of May, they found that they were unable to support it, and she tried to get it taken into several homes for children, and among others, Miss Sterling's home. But Miss Sterling always refused because, she said, the child was illegitimate. At last, one Monday, after she had unsuccessfully tried to get the child into a home, she got very much the worse for drink, and she told Thomas Pearson that she was going to take the child to Miss Sterling's home and that it would be after 8 o'clock before she would return. Pearson went out and did not come back till after 10 o'clock. While he was away, she strangled the child. She did this because she had no other means of supporting it. After it was dead, she wrapped it in a cloak and placed it in a cupboard. It lay there for about 3 days when they removed from Cannon Mills to Stockbridge. She placed the body in a closet or cellar at Stockbridge, where it remained until about a fortnight before. She took Pearson's waterproof coat to wrap the body in order to keep the smell from coming out. Pearson asked about his coat, and she said that it had got spoiled with green mould and that she had thrown it out. He said that was a pity. Pearson did not know about the death of the child. One day, as they were passing Miss Sterling's home, Pearson wanted to buy a toy for it, but she put him off by telling him that men were not allowed into the home. About a fortnight before that, she placed the body of the child in a piece of ground on Shane Street. Regarding the child Tomlinson, prisoner said she got £2 to adopt it, and that Pearson knew nothing about it. After getting the child, she brought it home and gave it some whiskey to keep it quiet. The whiskey was stronger than she thought and took away its breath, and while it lay gasping, she put her hand upon its mouth and choked it. Mr. Veitch's voice at this passage almost filled him with emotion. After the child was dead, she put the body into the cellar she had already mentioned, and it lay there till it was found by the police. She had tied a cloth over its mouth after it was dead, for fear it might come to life after she was out and make a noise. In her third declaration on 28th of November, prisoner, on being shown a letter dated 21 Dalkeith Road, said she did not wish to say anything then with reference to the letter or to the charge against her of having, on 5th of November 1887, in the house at 24 Dalkeith Road, strangled an infant named Walter Campbell Anderson, or Walter Anderson Campbell, son of Elizabeth Campbell, wire worker, Preston Pans. And then in 1889, the Edinburgh Evening News reported on her execution. So this is the excerpt from the newspaper. Execution of Jessie Keane, the Stockbridge murderess. This morning, Jessie King, or Keane, the notorious baby farmer and murderess, paid the penalty of her crimes at the hand of the hangman in the prison of Edinburgh. Since the date of the sentence on 18th of February, comparatively little interest has been taken in the case by the public, the feeling being general that so long as the law of capital punishment existed, the present was just the description of case that ought to come within its scope. The circumstances surrounding the crimes were so revolting, and the fact that the murders had extended over a period of time and were committed deliberately by a woman on infants and for the purposes of gain was such an outrage to the feelings of the general community that most people would not have been satisfied with anything else than the infliction of the extreme penalty of the law. Especially was this feeling prevalent among the women of the city, whose indignation at the crimes was very pronounced. One woman going so far in her expressions of loathing as to say that she would rather pull the rope herself than hear of the sentence being commuted. So that was from the day of her execution. Now, I've also got some information here on, so she was, when she was sent to prison, she was sent to Calton Jail.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist anymore, but what I've done is I've got a bit of information about it, just because it is quite interesting, so I thought you might want to hear a little bit about it before I finish up. Calton Jail, it was originally spelt in Old Scots, so jail being spelt G-A-O-L, so like Gael. So Calton Jail was an impressive, huge building, but was known to be a cruel and cold place, where inmates were treated poorly and human rights were almost non-existent. In the early days of the prison's existence, both male and female inmates were fastened to a long iron bar with heavy chains and were left attached to the wall in their cell without access to sunlight or exercise until it was time for them to be hanged. It became Scotland's main prison of the time and opened in 1817 to replace the old toll booth on the high street, which was deteriorating. Demolition eventually began in 1930 with anti-war protesters being the last among the inmates held there. The existing inmates were moved to Sockton Prison, which still exists to this day. Visitors to Edinburgh often mistook the building for Edinburgh Castle. It was home to Burke and Hare, suffragettes and people charged with petty crimes such as being drunk in public. All that remains of the prison is the Governor's House on Calton Hill, though the death cell door can be viewed in the Beehive pub in the Grassmarket. St Andrew's House, the headquarters of the Scottish Government, now stands on the site where the jail was previously. The bodies of those executed by capital punishment are still buried under St Andrew's House, and they include Eugene Marie Chantrell, hanged on the 31st of May 1878 for murdering his wife by gas poisoning, Robert Vickers and William Innes, two Gorebridge miners executed on March 31st, 1884 for killing a gamekeeper, Jesse King on March 11, 1889, Patrick Higgins, a labourer from Linlithgow who murdered his two sons and threw them into a quarry on October 2nd, 1913, John Henry Savage, who had quarrelled with a woman in a house in Bridge Street, Leith, and cut her throat, June 11, 1923, and Philip Murray, who was the last person to face the hangman's drop on October 30, 1923. Arriving home in Jamaica Street, he found a man in his wife's bedroom and pushed him through a top floor window to his death. And I've got a couple of pictures here as well, which I'll maybe put on the Instagram. I mean, the prison was, I mean, it looks like a fortress. It's huge.
I can't even imagine it. Where is St Andrew's House? Is that, it's not the Parliament building then? No.
No, it's on Calton Hill.
Right, okay.
To be honest, I'm not really familiar with that part of Edinburgh. I'm ashamed to say I hadn't even heard of St Andrew's House when I was looking into this.
So you can still see the Governor's House. I recognise that. That's the thing with the turret. Yeah, okay. So that was part of it. Oh my goodness, yeah, just looked it up. That's enormous.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like a mansion or something.
It does, doesn't it? Do you know, it actually looks like the school, the old school for the blind at Haymarket.
It does. You're right. It does. It's a beautiful building.
Yeah.
It's pretty terrifying, though, what happened there. And the pub, you can go to, which pub was it?
So it's the pub's called the Beehive in the Grassmarket, and they have the death cell door, which they actually have it in the pub. I think it's on the first floor, and you can go and see it, and that's from the prison. But also, apparently, a few of the original cells were still in existence under St Andrew's House. I don't know if they are now. It didn't sound like they were, but previously they were still in existence under St Andrew's House. And obviously you've got, did I say it's called the Governor's House?
Yes.
Yeah, the Governor's House, which is the turret, and that's the only remaining part of Calton Jail.
Wow. That's amazing. So the story that she told, it sounds like it was to protect him.
Yeah. I mean, from the accounts and stuff, it sounds like, from what people have said, that, you know, she was quite an amenable person. You know, she obviously responded to people that were in a position of authority, but it sounded like she was just quite an obedient person, and it sounds like he was maybe a bit domineering, you know, the impression that I get, and he kind of just had her under his control, really. I don't believe in his ignorance. I don't believe in his ignorance at all. I think that he was completely aware of what was going on.
And he let her take the fall.
Yeah, and also there didn't seem to be any information about the whereabouts of her baby, Grace.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, yeah, so the other child, but at the time she was arrested, she had a baby called Thomas. That was hers. And obviously she was, because in Calton Jail, women were in prison with their children. You know, the infants.
What?
Yeah, the infants were there as well, if they had them.
So what would happen to them once, say, the mother was hanged?
Well, he was housed through the Catholic Church, wasn't he? He wasn't...
Was he legitimate, though? Were they married?
They weren't married, so I don't know if that would be classed as illegitimate at that time.
Oh, okay. If they were common law.
Actually, he wasn't... Yeah, so Thomas, he obviously was Thomas's son. But her baby Grace, she was pregnant with Grace when she met him. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like it was likely that she fell pregnant as a result of working as a prostitute.
Okay.
And, you know, she'd met this man who'd promised to marry her. And then she'd come across Pearson. And then, the engagement to this man broke away sort of really shortly after she met Pearson.
It's bad enough having to sell your child because... you can't afford to look after them, but then essentially to then find out that they were murdered, and that last money that you had was stolen essentially from you. That's horrible.
Yeah.
Gosh, I didn't know that, and I didn't know that that was still there up until 1930, did you say?
Yeah, so the Calton Jail opened in 1817. And yeah, it was in existence. And I think there was an excerpt which said that basically the treatment there was terrible. It was really well known that it was just, it was abhorrent, basically. And they mentioned the diet. They were eventually allowed 1 hour of exercise a day. And the diet consisted of thick porridge with soured milk. For breakfast, lunch was soup and stale bread, and dinner was thick porridge and soured milk.
I mean, I know a lot of people that argue that our prisons are too soft nowadays, but I think if we could meet somewhere in the middle for human rights reasons, that would be good. Yeah, that's... I don't know.
I don't know how to feel about that one.
Yeah, I don't know how to feel about it.
To me, I mean, obviously, you know, we'll never know because it's, you know, a historic case now. But to me, it sounds like it was hard times anyway.
People were just trying to get by.
Yeah, women didn't have many options. She grew up, you know, she was an orphan herself. She bounced from institution to institution. She worked as like a laundry woman, and, you know, resorting to prostitution in order to, which was the term used at the time, to help support herself. If she was quite a sort of meek and mild-mannered individual, then, you know, she probably wouldn't fare too well on her own. She was probably quite easily domineered by, you know, a controlling man or whatever.
She might have also been kind of desensitized to violence and these kind of horrific acts. If babies were dying left, right, and center, and, you know, she's been in through quite a hard life anyway, it might be a kind of survival tactic, a dog-eat-dog environment that she's decided that that's the best way to deal with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you've heard similar stories before where they can justify it to themselves. You know, the mum thinks the baby's safe. Mum doesn't know any better. Baby doesn't need to grow up in a life of horrid, you know, poverty and being put in an institution and unloved. So it's really, really difficult.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, the options in that time were really, really limited. I mean, poor houses, I think they were called in Scotland. I don't know if they were also called workhouses in Scotland, but I know I've definitely seen the reference poor houses. They were horrific. You know, people didn't want to go there. It was, you know, it was akin to being in prison, basically. It was,
I think you were lucky if you survived it.
It was a last resort, and I think it was also, I think you had to meet a certain criteria as well to actually even be qualified to get in there. And, you know, with abortion not being available and, you know, contraception wasn't a thing. So although there would have been people that wanted children that maybe couldn't have them, or people wanted to foster, there would probably be far more children being born than could, you know, would massively, you know, outgrow that demand for any sort of fostering, yeah, or adoption, whatever. So, you know, they've got very limited options. If you happen to have sex and you get pregnant, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. There's absolutely, yeah, you have no choice. So you have no choice but to have that child. And if you don't have the
unless
means,
of course you die in childbirth, because
exactly, yeah, which was also common in those days too. But
exactly,
if you survive and have that child, if it's illegitimate or you don't have the means to raise it, what are your options? You know? So, and the thing is that baby farming, it was legal. It was allowed. So people would do it, you know. And I think there were places that were much more reputable, but I think people resorted to looking in newspapers and advertising in newspapers and things like that, because like what she was saying there about this Miss Sterling wouldn't take the children if they're illegitimate. So if you've got the reputable baby farmers, if they refuse to take illegitimate children, then already, again, your options are even more, yeah, limited.
You're getting more desperate, aren't you?
You're getting more desperate. So you're going to resort to, you know, even more sort of dire measures in order to rid yourself of this child that you cannot or do not want to raise, basically. And then, you know, people would advertise for baby farmers in the newspaper and people would respond to them, or baby farmers themselves would advertise in the newspapers, and that's how they would make their money, basically. So it was really commonplace at the time. It was a common practice, but
it's so transactional, isn't it? It's so
you're giving your child away, and you're also giving money to the person that's taking your child.
Yeah, you're paying someone to take the child. But yeah, I think that in obviously the time that's elapsed since then, there's been such a reframing of adoption, and thankfully we're in a much better place now.
Oh, good God, yeah.
But it's so hard. It's so, so hard.
I mean, contraception as well in itself, not that I want to get into this whole debate and discussion because it's a huge one, but everyone has a right to make a choice.
Yeah.
You know, there's contraception, and obviously abortion is legal now, and
in some places, not in others, and in other places they're trying to get it overturned as well. So
exactly, but there are circumstances where, you know, some people are for it and some people are against it, but there are circumstances where, for example, you know, if somebody's been the victim of abuse, falls, you know, pregnant as a result of abuse, I mean, that's a perfect example of where, you know, why it should be allowed, because not all pregnancy is between two people in a loving, committed relationship.
Yeah, and I think the ones that get it for me, and you know, I do believe everyone's entitled to their own view. I think it's really difficult when you're getting down to the morality of when is a life and when is a life formed and all that kind of stuff. I'm not qualified to answer that. I do believe personally that abortions should be available to anyone who needs one and wants one, and that the life of the person carrying the child is ultimately more important than a child that's not yet born. That's what I believe. But something that I do think that's really upset me recently was that in Poland they have now made it illegal for someone to seek an abortion even if the fetus is not medically viable. So, yeah, so unfortunately people are having to carry to term non-medically viable.
That's horrific.
Fetuses, and then they either pass away or they're stillborn, or they have to then unfortunately watch them pass away after a short period of time because they know that they had congenital defects, and it's really, really heartbreaking. So there's now in 2021 an illegal abortion scheme. Yeah, like you can go and get, you have to leave Poland to go and get an abortion. You have to illegally obtain an abortion now if you were in that situation, or if you just wanted an abortion for whatever reason you don't, you know, whatever it you require one for. But I think a lot of people would struggle to argue that it's not a good idea to not force someone to go through the trauma of carrying that child's term and having to go
That's
through
cruel.
With it. It's horrific, yeah. The only I once read a story about a couple that I just have so much respect for, and they had a child that they knew wouldn't live for very long after it was born, but the doctors essentially said to them, if you do carry your child's term, he could donate his organs. And they chose to go through the whole pregnancy and have the child, and they managed to donate the organs and save other babies and small children's lives. And I
just have,
I can't even begin to understand the depth of humanity that you need to have to be able to do that and to put yourself through that, and to carry a baby in your body knowing full well that it's not going to turn into a member of your family must be so incredibly difficult. But these can be really upsetting topics, so please do seek support if it's something that has upset you. There's lots of societies and charities out there that can support you.
Absolutely. And there's lots of services. So, you know, if you are in that position and you are seeking advice, support, anything like that, then please search for the local services in your country and, yeah, make use of the services because that's what they're there for.
It's just so hard knowing that these problems have always faced people, isn't it? I think that's something that I love about history and I hate about it at the same time, is that you can go back throughout the decades and centuries and to the beginning of humanity, and it feels like there's some problems that are always going to be universal, and there's some issues. I know that there's so many great strides being made in different social causes, but I just happen to believe that as part of humanity, there are bad people out there, and you know, there will be hurt, unfortunately, in the world, and bad things do happen, and, you know, illnesses happen and things like that. So there's that thread that kind of ties us all the way back. So when you listen to these stories and you can feel how these women would have felt.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's, in a way, it's a good thing, though. It connects us as humans, doesn't it?
Yep, it really does. It really does. And I think it brings a bit of life to those stories when you think back to how desperate these people must have felt. And I'm not in a place to judge her. I don't know how I would have coped in that situation. If she even actually did kill them. If it wasn't him, then she covered for him.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I enjoyed that.
I do enjoy the historic ones. And again, having done that case, it's made me think I need to pick up my lost Edinburgh book, because I'll bet Colton Jail's covered in that.
Yeah, definitely. I love the old pictures as well. I think most people feel that way about wherever they live or wherever they've grown up or have an affinity for. If you take the pictures and they superimpose them, I see that a lot. I find it really interesting when you look at a street and it's the street like 150 years ago and then the street today. I love seeing that. That just,
yeah,
something kind of magical about it, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So do you have a funny story for us?
I do, yes. I'm still Yeah, I'm still in my Florida Man binging because it's like, I think I've said this before, it's just the gift that keeps on giving. Like there's something about Florida. It's just a magical place that crazy things happen and I love it.
I actually have a comment to make. You know how you're talking about Florida Man?
Yes.
Do you remember in our last episode how I said I've been listening to a podcast called Where's George Gibney?
Yes.
Guess where he lives?
Is he in Florida?
Yes.
Oh, so he's a Florida man now.
He is.
Oh, well, now we'll have loads of stories about him, no doubt, as well. Okay. So, let me grab the... Grab this. Sorry, one second. In Florida, in 2012, a man tried to enter a strip club. He was denied entry to the strip club and he called 911. And the reason that he called 911 was that he had tried to bring his cat in with him. You can make all the jokes about taking a pussycat into a strip club if you like. But they were both refused entry. So he was actually charged on for misusing 911 at the Emerald City Gentlemen's Club. And it was shortly after 9 p.m, which I'm not being funny, but like, does this cat not have a bedtime? Because he should be, I mean, how old is this cat? He's definitely not of age. This is completely ridiculous. But they noted that when they spoke to him, he appeared intoxicated, which I'm sure brings you absolutely no surprise. And he basically started kicking off. They made him call a taxi. Then he started kicking off the taxi. And then he insisted the club owner had committed a crime by denying entry to the cat. And he kept calling 911. So he was arrested. And he was done for a few different things. And then he was held on a $4,000 bond. And you'd be glad to know that the kitten was reportedly in the custody of animal control. So the cat was all fine. Don't contact us about the cat. The cat is good.
So is that the end of the story, yeah?
That's the end of the story.
So was there any context about why he was trying to take his cat in there?
Nope, he just had a cat on him and decided he wanted to go to a strip club.
And was it so definitely his cat? It wasn't just like a random cat he found in the street?
Well, it says it was a kitten and it ended up in animal control's, care. So how do you come across? Did he just come across a kitten? I hear that a lot in America because loads of stray cats just having kittens everywhere. But he was adamant that it was his cat. So I don't...
Because the only thing I'm thinking is, like, you know, if sometimes if you give an animal attention and then it follows you.
Yes.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe he went to the strip club, he'd seen it, given it attention, walked to the strip club, and then it followed him.
I mean, I would take my cat everywhere if I could, but that's a bit far.
Do you think maybe if he had one of those cat strollers? Have you seen the ones that they have?
My neighbour has one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I know, it does look amazing, though. I was like, aww. I kind of want one.
I want one of the backpacks that looks like they're a spaceman if they look out of it.
Yeah, you know, the one I've got is not that one that you're talking about, but it's a different design, but it's a backpack.
My cats are too big for them, I think, probably.
Oh, mine is massive.
Oh.
Yeah, like Monty fits in mine.
I think if I tried to suggest to Richard us getting one each and walking down the street holding hands with the cats in the back, I might end up getting divorced.
Yeah, I think there's probably a small chance of that.
I would like to take them out and take them on a hike or something, but I just don't trust other people and
wild animals.
Yeah, I don't think my cats would like it.
I don't think my cats would like a strip club either, to be fair.
My cats complain when I try and take them anywhere, like in the carrier, even though the vet is literally like a 2-minute walk from our house, they will like just scream bloody murder the whole way.
Oh, it has occurred to me though, pretty much every cat owner that I know, their cat is a weirdo that likes to watch them in the shower. Do your cats come in when you're in the bath or the shower?
No, but Mika used to.
So maybe cats would like a strip club.
Yeah, maybe.
If they like naked people.
Aww. So there you go.
Love it.
you've been listening to Murder, She Spoke. If you've enjoyed listening to us, we would love it if you gave us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. If you want to get in contact with us, our email is info@murdershespoke.net, and we're also on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and we're on Twitter. Thank you so much. We will see you in a week.